And we are back. Thank you so much for sticking with us. And now it's time for my favorite time of the show, my favorite segment, where I get to interview smart guys that I think are have a lot of value to add. And this is today is no exception. It's one of our favorites, joined again by Kevin Muir, otherwise known as the Macro Tourist. Kevin, how the heck are you?
Great, man. It's great to be with you today, Zach.
Yeah.
How are things with you guys?
We're doing good, man. We're doing good. No complaints. Got to tell you, man, I've been enjoying this, the commodity action and the action in value specifically.
Yeah, and, long-suffering value bears have finally got a little bit of a day in the sun, right?
Good golly. I was joking around. I felt like I kind of felt like I knew what it was like to be a tech investor for the last 10 years. You know? After missing that party.
That's right. You actually had stocks that had green on the screen instead of red.
Yeah, I know. I thought something was wrong with my monitor. You know, just going, what is all this stuff? I have green arrows. I don't know what that is. But I read your recent I always read your stuff, but your recent letter really hit on some great points and some stuff that I wanted to pick your brain about it. But before I get into that, we are recording on a Wednesday. I got to head out of town, and Kevin was busy, so we made it happen on a Wednesday today. And this is the day where, let me just check, Kevin, before I make this assertion here. This is the day where the movie theater company, AMC, is up 101.25%. What do you make, and I don't want to spend too much time on this, because the overall media, right, is you know, falling all over themselves over this story, and I understand why. This is a market that continues to be unlike any I've ever navigated. I haven't been doing this as long as you have. What do you make of the market in general right now? Just kind of more your global thoughts, what you're seeing, what you make of this action, things like AMC. How are you interpreting it all?
Okay, so AMC is absolutely insane. It's up there with the GameStop. I'm pulling it up. You know, you can implied volatility is kind of the market's estimate of how much volatility you're going to see in the stock. Usually these things, you know, might be 50, 60, 100 used to be a big deal. I'm looking at like 1 week call options, and they're trading at 800, 900 volatility. I've never seen this.
God.
Like, I've just never seen this. And to get a sense of what that means, even here, let's just take the June options, which have 16 days, okay? Stocks at $64 as we're taping this. The straddle, meaning if you sold both the call and the put, the stock's at $64, and if you sold a $64 call and a $64 put, it's $60 bid.
Get out of here.
60. Yeah.
Holy like
so it's insane. So when you're looking at these things, you have to realize that this is a squeeze. There's things going on. I'm not sure how much of it's retail, how much of it's hedge funds playing games, but this is long, you know, past the kind of the era of responsible investing, and this is just pure speculation. And that's all there is to it. You should probably just, if you're a real investor, you should just steer clear of this thing.
Yeah. Now, the other thing I wanted to, because everybody gets stuck on these memes. And, you know, if they're isolated to one or two different stocks, or, you know, to me, that's not a big deal. Obviously, it still grabs the headlines, but it doesn't impact things too much. And I know you look at this stuff. I have not paid attention to it just as far as I'm noticing it as it relates to our investments in our portfolio. But one of the things I find really interesting, and this has been going on for quite some time, so it's not new, but I continue to be impressed by the lack of volatility on the overall indexes and what appears to me to be massive single stock volatility. Are there metrics to that? Are you seeing that same thing?
Well, for sure you can see that. You can talk about that. That's the dispersion and what's one trading at. And I actually had a buddy, a good, you know, professional trader, email me this morning and say, I got to buy some VIX because he was looking at this AMC and some of these other names and assuming that there was pain out there in the market. And I said to him, the problem about the VIX is that it's actually trading at levels that are higher than what the market is realizing.
Right.
Meaning that the actual volatility, like I think I saw something, a stat today, that over the last 5 days, the S&P has closed within 25 beeps, meaning 0.25% of the open or the close.
I know.
It's gone nowhere. So it's a great observation, Zach, that, you know, we're seeing all these crazy things happening in individual stocks. But the reality is that the index is actually settling down. And I would say go even farther, that even when we did have a little bit of problems in the market, if you looked at it, if you were a value investor like you and I, and you were in, let's just take the IWN, which is the Russell 2000 Value Index. Have I got that symbol right? Let me just dial it here.
Yeah, I think that's it.
I think I did. If you go look at that, even when we had that big sell-off and tech was getting hammered and the NASDAQ was going down, this thing barely budged.
Yeah.
So that's one of the things that it's a great observation that you've kind of highlighted, is that we're seeing some volatility and we're seeing lots of volatility in certain names. And it's been to the positive and it's been to the negative, and now it's back to the positive again. But if you're just a regular investor and you're out, you know, picking away at some good value stocks, you don't need to have like all the action that's in the headlines. Forget about those things. Like nobody's trading, like apart from a few pros, nobody's trading AMC well. Yeah, you're going to hear about somebody at a cocktail party that's made lots of money on it. But then they're going to turn around and, you know, 2 months from now, you're going to find out that they blew up on some other name or on that particular name.
Right.
You know. There's a big difference between traders and investors. And for anybody that's, you know, an investor, I would just, stay away from the meme stocks.
Yeah. I was working out with my personal trainer this morning, and he's, I've been trying to talk him off the speculative ledge. He's
a young millennial fellow that loves the Dogecoin and the GameStop and all these things.
Oh yeah. And to his credit, he's taken the advice, and he's been making some really good money on some commodity plays and some value plays. But you watch this action, and part of me cringes just because we all know how this ends, right? I mean, at some point, this thing just runs out of steam and goes no bid and just plummets. And it's just crazy to me, though, to see the disparate moves in this market and have you ever seen anything that comps to some of the anomalies that we're seeing? I mean, is it reminiscent of 99? Again, I've got very good memories of 99, but I wasn't running a portfolio then. I know you were.
Actually a derivatives trader at a big Canadian bank at the time. And there was no doubt that there was pockets that were very similar to today. But I would argue that today is way, way more speculative than then.
Yeah.
There were pockets, there were people doing this, but it wasn't as far reaching. It wasn't as fast. That's the other thing I would say, that this is way, way faster. And I think that has a lot to do with the fact that the internet and the transfer of information has made it so much quicker. In my day, when we were on the desk, you know, we were at a huge advantage. We had, you know, CNBC feeds. We had all, you know, we talked to traders. We knew what was going on as quick or more quickly than almost anyone out there. Nowadays, you know, someone at home in their pajamas can be every bit as, plugged in as a person, you know, working at Goldman Sachs on the trading desk.
Right, right.
And that's where it's gotten different. And so I found that the speed upon which it goes is increased. Now, the other thing I'd like to say is that I've had this theme for a while. I called it a series of rolling bubbles.
Yeah.
And I noticed this kind of like midway through the 2010s, like, you know, maybe towards the end, 2016, I started to notice that what you'd find is because there was so little alpha, meaning that there was tough to find something that was really, you know, exciting and undervalued and could really move the needle with your investment, you would find that, you know, a bunch of smart investors would get into something. It would get kind of, you know, they would tell their friends and they would start to get a bid. And then all of a sudden they would get on TV and tell more people about it. And it would all of a sudden become self-fulfilling, and it would just kind of start to rise. And you know, eventually it was going up because it was going up, meaning that the price action was actually attracting people to it.
Yep.
And then what you'd find is you know, and you can go through a whole host of different kind of themes that occurred during this time, and you could see the hedge funds get all excited about this, and this was the trade. Everyone had it on, and it worked for 6 months, 9 months, and then it just kind of collapsed.
Right.
And it wasn't as like dramatic as we see now, but it was definitely there. And I used to say, just, you know, hedge funds are all over this trade today. They're going to be all over the next one, you know, in a few months. Just be aware and don't get too caught up in it. Well, what I've found that, you know, since COVID and since there's been so much more kind of juice in the market, meaning so much more, you know, kind of fuel for these sorts of things to occur, both the magnitude of the rise and the speed of the rise has just been exponential compared to where we used to be.
Well, I mean,
and that's the big difference.
You look at Bed Bath & Beyond, for instance. That was one that we made a lot of money on earlier in COVID. I picked it up around $4 and ended up dumping it in January for like 46. Trimmed on the way up. I didn't get a straight 10X on it. But I was looking at that one this morning because I actually think that company's got some real wheels. And I was hoping that it'd get a pullback into a range that would make it attractive. And it started getting there. And then I pulled it up this morning, and at one point it was like, you know, up 1% on the day. Kev, I think it was probably 45 minutes to an hour later I pulled it up, and it was up 42%.
I know.
Just so out of nowhere.
Tell me what changed in the prospects of this company for it to go up that fast, that quick. Like, it doesn't, you know, and that's the one thing everyone needs to be aware of. It has gotten much scarier, and the ability to get hurt if you're fading those things, and that is the one thing I would really counsel, is be very, very careful, because there's all sorts of traders that are old school like me that used to go and used to sell these kind of rallies. And I think GameStop really, really changed that game and made it so that this is no longer something in terms of if you find yourself saying it's gone too far too fast and you're shorting it, which is a lot different than just selling your long. There's nothing wrong with selling your long if, you know, it's right. Gone too far too fast. But to short it because something's gone too far too fast, I think is a fool's errand in this market.
I know. It's crazy to hear that.
That's what I'm trying my hardest to not do that. Like, that is, you know, as a professional trader, there, you know, a lot of times we are on the other side of those liquidity demands from retail that you get, and there's good money to be made. But the thing is, the world changed. The world changed dramatically after COVID. And I think that just the fact that, as I say, there's so much fuel out there that the previous metrics upon which you thought was something was too far too fast have all of a sudden completely been kind of rejiggered.
Yeah. The other one, and I hate categorizing it this way, because and I know, you know, having talked to you several times, and I'm pretty sure you'd probably agree, but one of the things I've learned about markets is, you know, avoid the silver bullet theory, right? It's like it's never the one thing, right? It's usually a confluence of events. So I don't want to try to pin it on that. But one of the things I've noticed that seems strikingly different about this market, and I don't know if it's driven by a level of cynicism or internet access, whatever it is, but the truly unique part of this one is you'll hear traders, you'll hear retail folks. I had a conversation with a guy on the phone the other day that acknowledge that the AMC thing is ridiculous, acknowledge that the company isn't worth anywhere near that, and the company should probably be bankrupt. And then you ask them, and it's their biggest position in their portfolio.
Yeah.
Right, like it's not like that they're tricked into thinking they know it's BS. They know they're playing a game.
Well, how about Portnoy, Dave Portnoy, who's kind of become one of the celebrity stars of the post COVID kind of markets? He got on there and you know, told everyone he was buying a crypto. I can't remember which one it was. Some Safe Moon, something
yeah,
Moon.
Yeah, Safe Moon.
And he was full on said, you know, this is a Ponzi, but if you get in early on the Ponzi, you can make money. Like, what's that about? Like, people openly, like, aren't you supposed to go to jail for Ponzi's? Like, you know, isn't that what Madoff was in jail for? And yet now we've gotten to this environment where people are openly saying, yeah, it's a Ponzi, but I'm going to be the first in the Ponzi.
What do you – and again, there's no silver bullet, because these things are so complex, right? Investor behavior, people – what do you make of all this? I just don't know what to make of it all.
So I think the markets will eventually figure it all out. And yeah. and everyone that's telling me that, you know, markets are broken, blah, 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 blah. If markets go through periods where the kind of madness of people cause it to do funny things, but in the long run, markets figure it out. And I am a big believer that, that you will see eventually the market kind of, you know, separate the wheat from the chaff, and you'll see that the ones that should be there will continue to do well, and the ones that don't shouldn't be, you know. And that's, this is just a kind of a unique period in time, because coming out of the COVID, we had so much stimulus in many different forms, both monetary and fiscal, shoved into the market, that it's kind of created a perfect environment for speculation. And it, you know, it was even worse because everyone was at home with, you know, nothing to do,
drinking,
no sports to bet on. Like Dave Portnoy is a perfect example. The reason he started trading was because they stopped all the sports. He's a huge, no, honestly,
yeah,
he was,
yeah.
He's a big sports gambler.
Yeah.
So they stopped sports, and he's like, "Well, what do I do now?" And he goes, "Well, the stock market's still open."
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's how, why he came. And so, yes, there's no doubt that the market is going through periods where it's, some funny things are happening, but I wouldn't get too despondent on it. The market will eventually figure it out, and you know, the fool will be separated from their, you know, the money, and Nick, that's the end of the day. Like that, oh, it always happens. It's always the same. It's no different. It only, you know, the only thing that seems different is when you're in it, it seems to last longer and seem crazier. But the reality is that we've seen this play out many, many times.
Yeah. And I think that that's universal in life, but also specifically in the markets, right? It always takes longer than you think.
Like what's it? I think there's some joke. Those who study history will have to sit around and watch those who don't study history make the same mistakes, right?
Yeah,
something like that.
Yeah.
And,
I love that one. Yeah, those who know their history will have to sit there and endure the mistakes of those who don't, or something along those lines.
Yeah.
Okay, so to move to another hot topic that's right up your alley. I mean, you are the macro tourist, and we're just going to jump right into the deep end of the pool. Do you think that inflation that we're seeing, do you think it's transitory, or do you think that we've turned the corner?
Okay. So I do believe that there was a 1981 style kind of shift in the way we think about economics and financial markets and the economy during COVID.
Mm-hmm.
And what do I mean by that? In 1981, Paul Volcker came, and at that time, people thought there was no way that we could go and break the back of inflation. There was all sorts of people who said that it's kind of inevitable. We're never going to be able to stop this inflation, blah, 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 blah. Volcker comes, and he cranks rates, and even though they didn't believe him for the first year, eventually he managed to pull it back, and then we've spent the last four decades of experiencing basically disinflation over and over again. And we could argue about like some portions of the market or some portions of the economy have experienced a lot of inflation, and completely agree. But let's face it, interest rates have gone from, what, 15% or something in 1981 down to, what were they at the lows? They were under 1 for the 30-year or whatever it was.
I think it was like right at 1, right at 0.9, yeah. 90 base points, I want to say, something like that.
So now, why do I think that we've gone through this transformation, and what has changed during COVID? So if we go back and we think about these last 40 years, we've responded every time that there's a slowdown by lowering interest rates. Right, that we did a monetary response, you know. So the economy gets into trouble. What do? They lower interest rates. Yep. Now, lowering interest rates, what does it do? It causes people to go out and borrow more and spend. So that would cause the economy to do better. So in essence, this was their solution to the problem all the way down. And they tuned solely based upon monetary means, right? And then 2008 comes, they go, what happens is we get into a lot of trouble. They lower rates to zero, and geez, doesn't look like the private sector or the consumer is going to spend anymore. So they go, holy smokes, what are we going to do? And they go and they start doing quantitative easing. They start doing Operation Twist. They do all these unconventional kind of monetary policies. During the way everyone's petrified that this is going to cause inflation, there's the op-eds in the Wall Street Journal, open letters to the Ben Bernanke telling him how terrible this is, yet it never really causes the inflation. Yes, you could argue it caused inflation in asset prices, but it really never caused the traditional inflation. Okay, now why is that? The reality is that consumers don't borrow anymore, or even corporations for that matter, don't borrow anymore when the Fed goes and does quantitative easing. So let's just stop and think about, like, let's go through the transaction and think about what happens during quantitative easing. The Federal Reserve goes and they ask, the primary dealers, so we'll use JP Morgan, they ask them for an offering on some bonds. So they go and they buy, let's say $10 billion of bonds from JP Morgan. Now, the kind of the old school thinking was that they would take this money, JP Morgan would sell the bonds. Now, all of a sudden, they'd have all this cash and reserves on their system, and they would lend it out. And when they lent it out, that would be inflationary. Well, the reality is that JP Morgan doesn't lend out money based upon how many reserves they have in their system. Jamie Dimon doesn't go, oh, geez, now I have some, money on my sheets. I got to go lend it out. No, they make they choose their loans based upon their borrowers. They make based upon their own balance sheet and their forecast. So it has nothing to do with quantitative easing. So the reality is that quantitative easing doesn't do anything to create any real inflation. Okay, so now let's fast forward to COVID. This time, when we went and we got into trouble with the economy, yes, we did quantitative easing. But we recognized that quantitative easing wasn't going to be enough. And this is the big difference. We went and did fiscal. And yeah. We did tons of it. Mm. Tons, tons, tons of it. And we're still doing fiscal. And, I always say, don't, focus too much on what should be. Focus on what will be.
Yep.
And I kind of gotten just... It's the easiest way to sit there because a lot of people will say, this will end badly. This is terrible. And, I could make an argument it's not, and we could go through it all, but it doesn't even matter because, too many of, financial people sit around arguing about what should be done. Well, last I checked, the government's not, consulting with you to figure out what should be done. They're doing what they're doing what they're going to do.
Yep.
So why don't you just go figure out what they're doing and, arrange your portfolio correctly.
Yep.
So now... Let's just think about fiscal. This time, instead of it just being JP Morgan with cash on their balance sheet and, supposedly lending it out, they actually spent it. They gave it to people. And it's kind of hard to remember, and a lot of people have forgotten. But in March of 2020, everyone was so bearish. Everyone. And I remember sitting there and trying to tell people, if the government spends, if they step up, you're going to be shocked at the hole they can fill.
To your credit, I was looking through our DMs, and I saw the DM that you sent me at the end of March that literally said this exact same thing. Zach, just hold your nose and buy good names. That was the DM you sent me because of this reasoning. And I was hesitant. But I dipped my toe into the water based off that advice and a few other bits I'd gotten. And you were dead on the money, man. I mean, that was heck of a call.
It's the blind squirrel finds an acorn every now and then.
There you go.
But if you think about it, though, when the amount of money they shoved into the system, I wasn't bullish enough because I didn't expect them to do as much as they did. I remember getting the emails from the Federal Reserve on all the issues they were buying. And then I remember watching the deficits they were talking about. And I was like, these numbers are just huge.
Yeah.
People just don't we become numb to this. And because we had the 2008 situation with inflation, that everyone was worried about inflation in 2008, but yet it never came. So now we have this situation where everyone thinks the same. So actually, I should hurry on to your actual question, okay? After kind of a year and a half of the government spending like crazy and a lot of quantitative easing, we have finally got a situation where the market is realizing that there might be some inflation. And so what we're experiencing is some kind of commodities and certain jobs. We're running into supply bottlenecks, right? Take lumber. And lumber, what, went from $300 to $1,500, some crazy number like that. And yet, you know, the reality is that, like, was there anything really to justify that? Yeah, we were building some more houses, but no, it's kind of like all at once. There was a kind of a confluence of events. Like, we here in Canada, we couldn't actually cut enough of it quickly, and it just kind of all worked together, and we got this supply bottleneck. Anyways, we have this across the board. We have it in lumber, we have it in copper, we have it in all sorts of stuff. And so what we've seen is inflation expectations for the first time in decades go up. And they've gone up a fair bit. But one of the things that I kind of want to stress is that although everyone's sitting around warning about inflation, you'll see, like, for example, hedge fund legends like Stanley Druckenmiller talk about how this is such a terrible policy and that we're on the kind of edge of falling into an inflationary trap. When you look at the market and what it's pricing in, meaning like what is the actual, what are their concerns like with people spending their money, like making actual bets, you'll see that it doesn't disagree with the Fed's assessment. If you go look at inflation swaps, which is basically the institutional market of betting on inflation, you'll see that a one-year swap for inflation is 3.69%. Okay, a five-year swap is 2.66%. A 10-year swap is 2.54%. And a 30-year swap is 2.43%. So I look at this and I say, everyone's all excited about inflation and you know, telling the Fed they're making this terrible mistake, yet they're not actually changing their portfolios based upon it. They're not going out and buying the names that are going to benefit it. I contend that most endowments and long-term money, they're still sitting in, you know, tech stocks, yep, and other things like that. They haven't made the change. And so when people tell me that the market has gotten too excited about inflation, I will agree that most likely the short run inflation expectations are fully baked in, meaning that probably the next surprise is going to be the other way, meaning that inflation kind of ticks back down and it isn't as bad as everyone thinks. But having said that, I believe that the longer term inflation expectations are still got miles to go. And why do I believe that? I think you have to look very closely at what Biden is doing. And Biden is signaling that the tide has turned. Like, he's not going and trying to play this down the middle. Like, he's not going and saying, yeah, we need to balance the budget and, you know, like Bill Clinton did. No, he's saying this is time for, you know, historic actions. I read somewhere that Biden had two historians in the White House for 2 or 3 hours so he could talk about, you know, presidents of the past. To me, he looks like an old guy that realizes he's probably got one shot at it and that the Democrats only have one shot at it, because if they lose the midterms, nothing is going to get done. It's just going to be like Obama.
Yep.
And so they're going for it. And I think that the surprise will be how much he continues to spend and how aggressive they end up being. And then when you combine that with the Federal Reserve, in the past, the Federal Reserve always pushed back on any sorts of rises in prices. They have signaled time and time again that they're willing to look through this. And you just have to go, you know, forget about what you want them to do. Listen to what they're saying. They're telling you and they're signaling that they're not going to go and raise rates. And they're going to do it. So what you have is a Federal Reserve that is willing to accommodate a government that is going to be very aggressive on the fiscal side. And so when I think about kind of inflation and this trade, to me, it's just started. And I look at all these stocks and I think that they have a lot more to go. I think that you're going to find that in the past, it was kind of Wall Street over Main Street. And Main Street's going to start winning again. And that means that you need to own very much different stocks.
Agreed. Now, I want to run something by you. One of the things
and I'm not surprised by this, but my outlook is very similar. I think that you have had a tidal shift, right? I think that we have turned the corner. I think that COVID was a dramatic enough shake, like the way you put it. Like, it's just like that tidal shift with Volcker, right? It is a big enough shift to turn the ship. And I think that there are going to be bouts of inflationary scares. But one of the things I keep going back to is, you know, and this is digging into the psychology of the Fed, which I know you got to be careful when you do that because we're not there in the meetings and I don't know these people personally. But just, you know, stepping back and looking at it from a 30,000 foot view, if they're going to take all of these actions that they've taken since COVID and truthfully since they've taken since the financial crisis, the idea that they're going to step away all of a sudden, right? They can't. Right. I mean, in my opinion, they're in for a penny, in for a pound at this point. Right. Because they, you know, you've taken all these steps to prevent prices from falling. And in my opinion, if they were to pull out and let the market and the economy go on its own at this point, that would be the impetus for a big drop in prices. Right. With the very thing they've been trying to avoid for the last decade, you know, more than a decade. So I don't think they're going anywhere. Do you?
No, yeah, I completely agree, Zach. Like, I always ask my friends that are of the Austrian economists, and I always say, okay, so what would you have done? And they say, well, we need to let, you know, the markets figure it out. And they are always like, the government shouldn't have bailed in the banks in 2008. They should have let them collapse. And I go, yeah, okay. So I understand your argument, and I get it. But if they had done that, then we would have probably had a year or two of, you know, huge unemployment, lots of depression, and there would have been lots of issues. And the reality was that we didn't have the political will for it. So although that's what you want, it's not going to happen. Like, no. It's just not like we tried that route. That was the decision, you know, in 2008. We looked into the abyss and we decided we didn't want to go there. And to now somehow think that we're going to go back there is just foolish. And
yeah.
Then you might argue, okay, but it's not so bad. We're going to try to, you know, let's just try to balance it and let's try to, you know, stop spending so much. The reality is that all you have to do is look at Europe to see that trying to balance a budget in a time of limited private sector credit creation often results in a suboptimal, you know, response. And Europe is always my example because Europe – it's continued on the role of monetary dominance. You know, you have a fiscal dominance, monetary dominance. We've gone 40 years on monetary dominance, and now we've made the shift over to fiscal dominance. But, you know, you look at Europe, Europe is not embracing that as much, and that's part of the reason that they're having more trouble. And so I always say, well, fine, if you want to balance the books, like I always kind of laugh because I think to myself, they want to, these hard money people want to balance the books. And they want to raise rates. And I'm like, what do you think is going to happen to the economy if the government goes and cuts, you know, how much they spend, how much they're doing it, and then they're also raising rates? We're going to have a depression.
Yeah.
And they'll go, yeah, well, that's what we need. And I go, well, maybe. But the reality is not going to happen. So why are we even talking about it? So the alternative is that we try to balance the books, and then what happens is that the economy slows and we end up trying to do it like Europe. We try to do more and more monetary stimulus. And monetary stimulus doesn't work, especially when you hit the negative bound. I think all you have to think about is, like, take, you know, an Italian saver. You know, somebody that's sitting there and they're trying to save to put their kids through, you know, university, or they're trying to save for their retirement. Rates are at, you know, zero. And then they go to minus 50. And so the argument is that that's going to cause people to go spend. But if you think about the person that's saving, they still have the same obligation that they're saving for. That hasn't changed. So now they're earning less. So the reality is that they have to spend less because they need to save more. So it just doesn't work at the zero bound. And trying to, you know, to assume it will, it's been the real problem. Like, I contend that the book that got us into the most, you know, economic mess that we've ever had is This Time is Different by Rogoff and Reinhardt or whatever it was. And it was this book that argued that when you hit this kind of 80, 90% or 100% of GDP, you hit a crisis. And that's why in the great financial crisis, when we were thinking about what the government should do, the government, instead of spending and doing pro-cyclical, you know, expansion, go out and invest in our country when rates are low, when nobody can get a job, and when we need to do stuff. Instead of doing that, we actually did the opposite. We cut spending because we were worried about the total amount of debt. So we have the private sector, cutting credit, and then we had the government doing it at the same time. So you just, like, that book just drives me crazy. Like, I just, it's done more damage than anything else, because it's basically encouraged us to do pro-cyclical, you know, cuts when the economy needs the exact opposite.
Yeah.
And, you know, and so the next discussion we should have, Zach, is that, you know, that's all fine and good for me to say that you can spend now, everything's going to be great, the government is, you know, has this ability to, you know, has more room to spend on the fiscal side than we've ever imagined. But the reality is that they're politicians and that eventually they're going to abuse it. And I'm the first one to tell you that, of course, they're going to abuse it. They're going to abuse it just like the monetarist abused, you know, monetary policy. Like, I look at, you know, Europe with minus 50 basis points. I look with the U.S. with quantitative easing out the yin-yang. Those are abuses of monetary policy.
Right.
So, like, why is one just so terrible and one so great?
The other thing, too, is that to me, and I jokingly said on a previous show that I think what happened back in March is not, it didn't open Pandora's box, but it opened it, gutted it, and then burned it. Meaning that, going to your point about what should be done, it to me is just meaningless. Again, they're popularly elected public officials. What are they going to do? They're going to take the route or the path of least resistance that leads to them getting reelected. And that's handing out money, right? It always has been, right? I just don't, like you said. And then the other thing, because my core, I'm one of those hard money guys. Just because
I know you are, Zach. I know you.
and I firmly believe, right, the bill will come due. Having said that, if you put me at the head of the Fed right now, I don't know that my actions would be all that different. And I think that kind of goes to the unique setup of this whole situation, right? This wasn't a bailout of irresponsible companies doing, there was certainly some of that, especially like, you know, the airline companies buying back stock and, you know, things like that. There was certainly some of that, but this was a government created situation, right? I think you could argue that one of the abuses of monetary policy was the fact that they shut down the economy to begin with, right? Meaning there's no way they shut down the economy the way they do unless they've got the confidence that the Federal Reserve can just, you know, print the difference and fill in the hole, right?
Do you think that?
If you think back to you know, the Spanish flu, they didn't shut down the entire economy. I don't think that there's any way that they would have done that action unless they thought they could print and fill the hole. I don't know.
That's an interesting way to think about it. I think that they were spitballing more than you think. They were just like, we got to shut it down, and then they figured it out after. And I think that there was some scary days there when the reason that they overwhelmed it on the bond market, on the bond market side, was because I think there were some scary days there that we were that the system was closer to failing than we realize.
I think there's
a famous book Marty Schwartz talks about. I think it's called Pitbull, and he, you know, I think it was during the 1987 crash that he went to the bank because he's worried about the system failing, and he emptied all of his gold, and then while he's taking his gold up Fifth Avenue, he has a heart attack or something like that because he's like holding it in this, you know, when it's a hot day or whatever, I don't know. I think that the system, or it's Mohammed Al-Rayan or whatever his name is, from when he was working at PIMCO, I believe that during the great financial crisis, he told his wife to go get, you know, 100 grand cash and get home because he, you know, he's there with a ringside seat knowing that it's closer to failing than we think. I think it was the same thing in the COVID. I think that they shut it down and then they were like, holy smokes, and this is really bad. And then they just started, they overwhelmed it with blue tickets, is what I always joke about. And I remember seeing those blue tickets when I got the emails from the Fed of what they bought, and it was just staggering. It was like 500 of the, you know, threes of 2042, and then like 750 of this, and I'm talking millions. Like, and there's just like, it was just, you know, issue after issue that they had bought. And I was just thinking to myself, how did they even do this? They must have just phoned up and lifted every offering, you know, on the screen.
And yeah.
It was just like, it's just shocking to me. And so, but having said that, you know, like, I kind of think that, you know, well, let's just talk a little bit about that the bill will come due. And one of the things that I always like to do in terms of a mental exercise is think about the Japanese kind of a situation that they're in. So they have 250% of their GDP is outstanding as debt. And they're one of the most highly indebted, you know, developed economies right out there, if not the most. And but the thing about it is the Bank of Japan owns half of it.
Right.
So now,
well, Kevin, isn't the Japanese people own like 45% of 45%? I mean, isn't, well,
yeah, I guess the other half is owned by like the Japanese the postal service or whatever. Right. Yeah, because the reality is nobody outside Japan really owns it. But if you think about the Bank of Japan, so the Bank of Japan, if they were to just imagine, take all of the issues that they had of like the long position. That's basically a short position against the government, and they just, you know, ripped it up overnight. Meaning that they say, you know what, like this bond, we're going to rip it up. Or even if you want to do something different, they just said, okay, we're going to rejigger it so that it's now, you know, a perpetual with 0.00001% interest. Okay, do you think anything would happen to the real economy?
You know what, I've spent a lot of time thinking about this. And I think I started thinking about this several years ago, just because when you, I'm not a forensic accountant by any stretch of the imagination. I've been doing this as long as you have. I can't see a problem that would cause.
Yeah. Listen, you could argue that the market will react negatively. And the reason the market will react negatively is because they'll all of a sudden realize that the government, you know, whereas before they were 250% of debt to GDP, they're now at 125. So they can spend more. So the reality is that they were never constrained by financial means. You know, back to my This Time is Different, that book that I can't stand. That was never the case. And the reality is what we are constrained by is inflation. Because if you take it to its next logical conclusion and you say, okay, if there's no financial constraint, that just can't be, because the reality is, and then, you know, why don't we just, you know, give everyone, you know, like all a bucket of money and it'll all be rainbows and unicorns and everything will be great. Well, the reality is when the government spends too much, you eventually create inflation. They start competing for real resources.
Right.
So they start doing it. And so, you know, that's why, you know, we're getting onto MMT, and this is at the core of MMT, and this is why I always kind of push back to the MMT people who say that the government will be able to control inflation. And I call them BS on that. I think the government, well, they're going to overdo it. Just like I said, you know, they overdid on the monetary, they're going to overdo on the fiscal. And it's just these waves, and this is how the market works. We go through periods when one, you know, school of thought wins, and for a while the Rogoff, you know, This Time is Different school of thought won, and therefore the governments were cutting back and, you know, not spending as much. And now it's the opposite. Now it's the MMT people's turn. And I think that we're going to have, you know, decades of this, because I think that the reality is at first it's going to be really good. At first it's actually going to be a little bit of a free lunch, because I believe that the economy was actually tuned in correctly, and that there were people that were underemployed that will now be able to be employed. So I think that it will work at first, but that eventually it'll get abused. But the difference is that, you know, where the government, you know, you combine this with the fact that the Federal Reserve has told you instead of a 2% target, they're going to now make it an average inflation targeting, which means that they're going to try to make it 2% over long periods of time, because in the past it had been almost a kind of a ceiling. Once it got above 2%, you found that the Federal Reserve quickly raised rates because they wanted to keep it below 2%. And what that ended up meaning was that there was very few times above 2%, and most of the time it was down below. So when you looked at it on average, it averaged 1.5. So now the Federal Reserve is going to say, well, if we go a year at 1%, that means that we can go a year at 3%. Which completely changes the, you know, the whole equation. And one of the things that you need to think about as an investor is, if we are correct and if we have seen a change from monetary dominance to fiscal dominance combined with a change of attitude with the Fed, that in the past you kind of had this disinflation and this belief that we were never going to have kind of a sustained inflation, that's going to all of a sudden be, you know, a real problem. And I contend that the bonds that are in your portfolio that used to be a nice ballast to, you know, the stocks going up and down, the bonds provided a ballast, I think that they might end up being the anchor that drags you down.
I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, I've been singing that song since 2012. You know, just saying, you know, this whole the role that they have played in the past, that game's over. It's not going to be a buffer to volatility. It hasn't been. You know, nothing has responded that way outside of treasuries. And people are like, well, I own treasuries. And I'm like, well, great. Well, then be happy making, you know, 1/3 the rate of inflation, right, on your treasuries. I mean, that's just, you know, it really is amazing to me, too, the way that this stuff is I was thinking about treasuries, and you and I may have talked about this in the past, but treasuries really have gone from being an investment to I kind of see them as really similar just to owning vol, right? I mean, you've got a negative carry in real terms, right?
Yep.
Like you do on vol. They go up when things get, you know, dicey, either by the market buying them because things are getting dicey or because we know that that's the Fed's first lever, right, is to start buying treasuries. And in that aspect, it's really fascinating, right? The way that all of this stuff is changed things and the way it's working. Now, one of the other things I wanted to hit on with you was you were talking about the things that Biden is doing, and it's funny that you pivoted to Biden because that was going to be one of the questions I had for you. Was at first glance, when I see the headlines of the policies he's pursuing and the things that he's going after, the, you know, the things he wants to put into place, especially as it regards, you know, climate change and Green New Deal and things like that. It looks to me like virtually everything he is doing is exceedingly inflationary, like it's going to be a boon. The one thing that I have not done and that I can't speak to is I haven't dug through some of these policies. For instance, you know, the announcement of not extending the leases in Alaska. Of the actions that he's taken, do you have any idea or feel at this point the actual real impact it will have on oil production? Is this window dressing, or is he actually taking real actions that are going to, you know, decrease supply, right? Is he really going to take supply offline or prevent it from coming back, or is this window dressing?
So it's not just Biden. And
right.
It's the whole world, and it's a complete change in attitude. And I've actually got I'm going to get boos from all your millennials and all the greens, but I've actually got energy as one of my top holdings right now.
It's my biggest.
Yeah, because I think that what they're doing is going to be bonkers. And it's not that I believe that pollution is bad. I do believe pollution is bad. There's no doubt in my mind. I want us to have less pollution. There's zero doubt in my mind I think coal's bad. I think we should get rid of coal. But having said that, this idea that we're going to be able to get rid of fossil fuels as quickly as we think is just like bat crap crazy.
Yeah,
it really is, because I think that we've been really foolish to understand, like, in terms of understanding how long this shift is going to take. And I'll just, so let's just forget about what should be done. Let's talk about what is being done in the spirit of what I preach. So I said that it wasn't just Biden. And the first thing is, all you have to look at is the past kind of few years. You've seen all the big endowments and money managers be increasingly stuck with this ESG mandate. And they've been slowly starving kind of fossil fuel companies of capital. meaning that they've been selling their shares. They're less likely to buy new deals. They want them off the sheets. So those things trade at lower and lower, you know, valuations. Then, since the COVID, we've kind of noticed a speeding up of this process, because now it's no longer just investors choosing to do this. It's actually governments, and in some ways, it's actually the kind of fuel company, the energy companies themselves. And one of the things that pushed me over the edge in terms of why I made this one of my biggest holdings is that if you looked last week, the International Energy Association released a report that they called Net Zero by 2050.
Yeah.
Okay. And so what this is a timetable to get themselves to net zero. And that's great. You know, I'm all for it. Let's try to get this. But one of the shocking things to me was that there was a kind of a very immediate mandate. And what it was no new oil and gas fields approved for development and no new coal mines. Okay, that's good. Fine. I'm good with the coal mines. But let's stop and think about this. And they put a timeline of 2021, at the end of 2021. So they are committing to having no new oil and gas come the end of 2021. And I'm just like, you know, like, this is crazy.
It's like a solution that you'd expect like a second grade class to come up with, right?
Yeah.
Like it's so cut and dry where you look at them and go, hey guys, you know, we live in the first world. Have you thought about the impacts this will have on poor people living in third world countries that can't afford your green energy solutions? Right? Like,
yeah.
there is other human prices to pay by your actions, and you're pretending as if your actions are purely moral and there's no downside. There's no cost.
Well, and the other thing about the electricity is that we're not going and looking at the cost of like mining all the cobalt and things like that. There's some huge problems on that side as well. Or the fact that a lot of times the energy is made from coal. Like, it's like, listen, I don't think we should worry too much about the politics behind it. Let's just think about like the economics behind this.
Amen.
And one of the things that I also thought was interesting was that I'm going to, you know, quote Javier Blas, which is, I believe, a Bloomberg a columnist. He says, turning point. Big oil has suffered a huge defeat today on its climate change strategy with Exxon, Chevron, and Shell enduring another big shareholder rebellions or losing important legal fights. Okay, so he says the likely consequences are the activists and climate change campaigners will be emboldened by their victories, okay? And so big oil will likely have to reduce CapEx even further. Now, this is the part that I agree with him, and he kind of summed up my point. He says, society seems to be trying to resolve climate change, focusing on supply rather than demand.
Yeah, yes.
And that, I think, is my main point. We have gone, and we as a society have chosen to basically starve energy companies of capital. And by doing so, we are setting up a situation where when the demand doesn't fall proportionally, we're going to have a spike in price. And one of the things that kind of frustrates me, listen, I have two university age daughters in my household and my wife. So I am a Canadian that believes that we should be getting a fair price for our oil. And I'm probably, even though I am very left on most things, I'm probably, let's just say I'm not as much in the kind of the green camp in terms of willingness to forgo everything. And one of the reasons that I'm not is because I think that a lot of times these people say things and they have all these great plans, and then when you ask them, how much are you willing to actually kind of forgo to, you know, achieve what you want, it ends up being a much lower number than you might guess. Like, I think they did a study once and they asked people, you know, okay, that's great that you want less climate change and stuff like that. How much are you willing to spend? And it was like $300 or something. And, you know, I get it. Not everyone makes a lot of money. So $300 on average is pretty a lot. But if you really truly believe in climate change, you shouldn't be flying around.
Or you better be. And then the other thing to your point is,
if you're supporting these activities, you better have no problem with $8 to $12 a gallon at the pump.
Right. Right? And that's kind of my point, is if I was in charge and I was trying to institute this change, to me, I would do gas taxes. I wouldn't go after supply. It's going to achieve the same thing, but it's just that it's one of them is going to, because it's going to make a shortage more quickly. Like, and it's going to go up because of a shortage. So I look at this and I see very little new supply coming on. And you combine that with the fact that when you look over time, every single kind of developed country hits a level of wealth and it's like a hockey stick. You know, the energy per, you know, demanded per person, it goes up a little, goes up a little, goes up a little. And then they reach a certain level of wealth and it explodes higher. And if you look at Japan coming out of World War II, it did this. You look at Korea in the 70s and 80s, it did this. And I contend that China is hitting that point where they're rich enough that, you know, everyone's going to have a car. Everyone's going to have an air conditioner. And yes, they're doing a good job at trying to, you know, do more electrical, you know, electric. Because let's face it, they're an oil importer and they actually have more of a need to do that because they don't want to be dependent on the rest of the world. But having said that, they are there's a huge amount of people. It's a monster economy.
Well, and isn't 70% of their grid coal powered?
It's something crazy. You know, that's like, don't get me started on Bitcoin, but if you stop and think about that, like the reality is that they were turning on actual Bitcoin, you know, coal energy grids to, you know, fuel their Bitcoin.
Well, I was dying laughing at Musk's tweet where he was saying that the reason he can't back up Bitcoin anymore is because of the coal power backing it. And I'm sitting there going, wait a second. Aren't you cozying up to the CCP to get your cars into China, which are all going to be charged by coal anyway? Like, come on. Right. Yeah.
But so we go back to, do we go back to the energy? I just think that they've told you that they're trying to solve their problem by having higher prices. Like the government's indicated to you, the all the big investors have indicated they're not going to do this. It just seems to me that this is what's going to happen. So the real question ends up being, how do you play this?
And that obviously is what I want to get to, but I don't want to interrupt you because I want to go down that road. But at the same time, looking at it from a slightly different angle, when it relates to the government actions taken in you know, all the stuff that we've talked about, right? What is this? I'm trying to think of the right way to formulate this question. Rather than just saying, okay, what are the things to go into? Like I said, I want to get into that. What are the more far-reaching consequences of this outside? For instance, where do we? Let's say we go. We continue down this path, which it looks like there's no way we're turning back at this point. You know, you don't want to say never, you know, just because life is long and never is a really long time. But what are the more, I guess, far-reaching implications of this? Because you and I know that I guess what I'm afraid of happening is looking at the way markets function. And if we are slowing down here on supply and work or on production and we're crimping that ability for the American economy to generate its own oil supply, doesn't that just mean that we're going to be exporting those dollars somewhere else in the world where they're not as hung up on this whole issue, and that they're just going to fill that gap and you know, maybe they don't have access to the oil reserves or things like that. But doesn't that just open up the ability? Basically, we're just kind of exporting that cash somewhere else.
Well, I'm not so sure I agree with that. First of all, you guys are a net exporter of oil. For the first time, right?
Like, but not nearly as much as we were pre-COVID.
Yeah, and not only that, oil is a globally traded commodity. So the reality is that it's up for you guys; it's up for everybody. Like,
yeah,
obviously, some are more than others. I would argue that I think what likely is going to happen is we're going to have a spike, and it's going to cause inflation. And I had this piece that I wrote, and the piece was basically after Stanley Druckenmiller, did his rant. He went on and he did this rant about how the Federal Reserve was playing with inflation, and this was all going to end badly. And I wrote this long, elaborate piece about how the reality is that, yes, he can complain all he wants, but, you know, the Federal Reserve has a new mandate, and the mandate is full employment. You just listen to them. They have much different views about it. They look at it, and I think that they have a valid kind of point that every time the economy started getting going, and those people that were, you know, the last ones to get a job were probably the ones most needing it to get a job, every time that started to, you know, do well, the Federal Reserve went and raised rates and slowed down the economy. It's almost like the Federal Reserve was guaranteeing a constant unemployment, right? Like, like if you stop and think about that, like, why were they kind of ensuring there would always be 5% of Americans without jobs?
Was that a relic from the Volcker years?
It's a Phillips curve trade. Yeah, they just think that causes inflation, and therefore that's the way. But I think that this Federal Reserve has, you know, made a decision otherwise. So my point being that the Federal Reserve and Wall Street are on kind of a path for a showdown, meaning that the Federal Reserve is listening to him and saying, yeah, we don't care. We you know, we're not going to worry about it. And so what I thought to myself was, I thought, okay, this means that whereas those inflation swaps that I talked about, you know, that the Federal Reserve watches those carefully. So they sit there and they say, okay, well, the reality is that the one-year swap is, you know, 3.5%, but, you know, 30-year swap is still 2.5%. So there's nothing to worry about. And to some extent, they're correct. So I thought to myself, really what's going to happen is that Wall Street is going to make it so that they're going to call the Fed's bluff. And so they're going to take those up. So I wrote this long, elaborate piece about how this was going to happen and that the Federal Reserve was going to basically start to get bullied around by Wall Street because we're going to start to see increased inflation expectations. And then this really smart strategist that subscribes to my letter and really nice guy, Louis Vincent Gav, he sends me this thing and he sends me a note. He says, you're making this way more complicated than it has to be. Wall Street's going to buy oil up. It's the easiest. It ends up being the fulcrum instrument that affects everything in terms of prices.
Well, and this goes back to our what we were discussing about with the ESG. But the way I viewed that is that as long as tech was running, right, and as long as the NASDAQ was cranking along, it was going to make that whole divesting of petroleum stocks and fossil fuel companies much more palatable. The minute that stuff starts ripping, watch those so-called ethics fly right out the window, yeah. Right? When it starts impacting performance, and you'll see them loading back up with both hands. And here's the other one that I think is really funny. Now, I don't have the exact stats on this. You might. The one that, and this just to me fits perfect for this environment that we're in, is that you got all these ESG rating mechanisms and equations, and every time you run the S&P through it, a bunch of the stocks that come out rated at the top are oil producers, right? Fossil fuel companies.
Yeah.
Right? And it really makes sense, right? Because these guys aren't stupid. They realize that this is a threat to their existence, and it just seems natural. And in fact, that's what's happening, that they're some of the biggest investors in green energy, right?
Yeah, but the reality is that they're still getting they're still becoming more and more a value trap. Nobody wants to own them. Even, you know, they're desperately trying to shed their image. But let's face it, if you go sit there and you have these on your portfolio, you're getting questioned. The woke generation doesn't like it.
I know. We added a cool name to our portfolio, Peabody. At about $3, $3.50, something like that. It's about a month and a half ago. And good client of mine, great guy, called up, and he's a little fired up about it.
Yeah.
And
I kind of sympathize. But that's fine, you know. And like he can't they tell you they don't want that name?
Here was the catch.
Yeah.
Within 3 weeks, we were up 130% on the position. Yeah. And so I said to him, I go, Well, you know, how much do you not like Cole? Do you not like it enough to forfeit the profits from the trade?
Yeah.
You know, and that's where the conversation ended. And
yeah. Well, I always tell people, Zach, I always say, you know, when I start to think about the ethics too much, obviously there's some things in investing that I just be like, no, that's a no-go for me.
Yep.
But when I start to think about it, if you go and start to, you know, put ethics on every investment, you'll find yourself with lots of reasons to not do a lot of things.
Oh,
I had a buddy, we were talking about China, and China's, you know, a bad one in terms of lots of people have very, you know, strong opinions. And I do too. I'm mad about how they've treated our country. You know, I'm a Canadian, and I'm mad about, you know, we have two Canadians that are locked up there, and basically that's retaliatory for us, you know, arresting the Huawei person for you guys. And anyways, I have lots of, you know, opinions, and there's no doubt that they do some terrible things. But we're just, you know, when you're stopping, you're thinking about bond markets, you know, it ends up being the bond market in China is one of the few bond markets in the world that has a positive real yield, meaning that it's above inflation, it's trading above. And so I was, you know, and then not only that, when you look at the currency, it trades, you know, with a huge carry. And not only that, all the FinTwit guys are telling you how it's always going down. And then meanwhile, you go look at the real, you know, the return of this thing. It's been one of the greatest trades ever, being long this thing. And I was talking to a buddy about this, and he was telling me, I won't give the Chinese money. And I said, okay. And he says, I believe too strongly in what they're doing to the, you know, to that area of Nepal.
Yeah.
Right, yeah. And I said, okay, I understand that. I appreciate that. But I said, like, you know, does that mean you're not buying an Apple computer? Yeah. Right? Like, you're not buying an iPhone? And he goes, like, no. And like, he kind of sheepishly said. And listen, I'm not trying to judge. And like, I try to live my life like as good as I can, and I try not to judge other people. But having said that, if you're going to start telling me that, you know, I can't invest in that, and so I'm not trying to at all say that. And you know, in terms of Peabody, it's been a great trade. It's just not for me though. The other reason that I think coal is a little bit scarier is that I think its time is less long than maybe we think. Because
well,
I think it's yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think, you know, for instance, you know, the world has plenty of natural gas.
Right, and to me, like, why don't we go just do that? It's like one step better, you know, than coal. So,
man, it's a lot better. I mean, you know, you can sit, I always say, like, if you just want to burn coal in your house, you're not going to want to be in there very long, right?
Like, just, that's true. That's a good point. I never thought about that.
You can turn on your natural gas burners on your stove and let those babies hum all day long, and it's not going to. You won't have any degradation of the air quality in your home. I think it's an infinitely better. And that's kind of one of the things. I'm with you, man. I love nature. You know, there is no benefit to any of us for the degradation of the environment, right? There just isn't. Yet at the same time, I struggle with the hilarity of it, right? The knee-jerk aspect of so many of these things, like, oh, natural gas is still a fossil fuel. And you're like, hey, guys, you're the ones always talking about progress, right? If you start subbing out natural gas, you know, or subbing out a lot of these other fossil fuels for natural gas, you'd see an instant improvement. I mean, it's a much cleaner burning type thing, but, you know, it still comes from the ground. So moving on to what you were getting to earlier is, where do you want to be? Where does the macro tourist think the most interesting plays are? And I would be remiss if we didn't discuss either, even if it's not a place you want to be, I'd still like to hear your take on uranium, because that one is we've been invested in that for about the last 10 to 12 months. Obviously, it's been a very good performer. But yeah, where should we be? And then specifically wanted to get your thoughts on uranium.
Okay. So we'll just finish up with the fossil fuels.
Okay.
That's been one of my big positions. I think that we're setting up for a spike in oil. I think it's going to end up doing really well. So when you think about what do you buy, so I trade futures. So I've obviously gone and bought the futures out, you know, many years, because the other interesting point about it is, much like the inflation swaps, all the kind of short-term demand is concentrated at the front, meaning the front, you know, crude oil is trading at $65, but you go out a year, it's 60, you go out 2 years, it's 57, you go out 3 years, it's 55. So to me, I think that we're going to see a situation where that's going to flip. You're going to see the far dated trading actually at huge premiums. So I bought far dated futures. But the other thing that I've liked to own is the Canadian oil sands. And I know I'm probably getting boos from the crowd for this, but I really would, you know, if anyone has a kind of an opinion that that is especially bad, I would kind of encourage them to go and look at this documentary called Over a Barrel. And Over a Barrel might kind of give you a different attitude about why oil sands are being viewed as such a bad kind of polluter, and that it might not be nearly as much kind of actual science as it is a function of, ironically, you might think that it's the kind of, it's ironically, it's a, it seems to be that it's American oil interests have had a reason to portray it that way, because ultimately they end up with better price for their own oil.
Okay.
And, you know, I just kind of, I get booed from all my, you know, BC, you know, people for this, but I'm going to read you something, and it's from a citizen in your actual wonderful city. And I thought this was a really funny thing. It appeared on a kind of in a newspaper, and it says, thanks to the citizens of BC who seem once again to have blocked an oil pipeline to the coast. Those of us living south of the border will continue to enjoy importing your oil at substantial discounts while exporting your oil from Gulf ports at world market prices. Your gift to us, around $100 million per day Canadian, is greatly appreciated. We marvel at your generosity while doubting your sanity. All of this, of course, will have zero impact on global climate. That's from Adam Lloyd of Seattle. Adam, I completely agree with you.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I think that the reason I buy the oil sands is that it's the one of the highest marginal cost with the longest kind of duration, meaning that it has the longest kind of reserves. And the reason you want the highest marginal cost is if you have a situation, it gets you more torque.
It's like an option.
Yeah. So you want, so to me, if you're a real big oil bull, that's what you want to own. So that's what I own. I bought, you know, the kind of granddaddy is Suncor. There's one called Meg Energy, which I believe is going to get taken out. It's probably the one last independent one. So that's it. And those are the ones I own there. Now on to your,
Other question on the oil sands or the, I thought the correct Canadian nomenclature was the tar sands.
Yeah. Okay. I'm not, I don't know what they, you know, what they actually want.
I want to,
tar sounds worse. I agree. Oil sands.
I agree, you're a big draw for the land of the North, pal. So I know when I've got you on the show, we're going to have a lot more of our Canadian brothers and sisters.
Well, you know what? But you're near BC. They all boo me for these things. This is not very BC like. Although I love BC and I do it, I really do believe that a lot of the kind of the Canadian energy situation has been mired with all sorts of competing interests that we have not been fully aware of, and that we might have been played more than we ever imagined.
Yeah.
Right? And that's kind of my thing. And my point is, why don't we go and why don't we make one of these pipelines and get that $100 million and put it towards our healthcare?
Yeah.
Put it towards something good. Like, why are we giving away money to the rest of the world? You know, and we're not slowing it down. And that's kind of my point. In my article about this, I compared this idea of going after supply for the energy, much like when 1980s, when Nancy Reagan, you know, they went after drug dealers.
Yep.
And yes, they had a Just Say No campaign, but that wasn't the key to it. The key was they tried to put away all the drug dealers. And so when you put away the supply without really changing the demand, all you're doing is changing the price.
Right.
So to me, I think, like, you know, drugs are a perfect example. Do I think that there should be heroin and on meth, you know, meth or whatever it is on the streets? No, but I would be much more inclined to try to convince our people and our society members not to take it than to try to put all the drug dealers in jail. Like, and don't get me wrong, I'm not trying to say drug dealers should be allowed to go around and do stuff, but I just think that where you put your kind of energy in terms of trying to fix behavior is important. And so when I look at this kind of our decision about how we're dealing with energy, I think we're going about it the wrong way. Like, why don't we go and put down the speed limit on our roads? Why don't we say you can't have, you know, our cars? Why don't, instead of us having 400 horsepower cars, why don't you put a limit on that? Why don't you figure out ways to, you know, reduce demand as opposed to trying to reduce supply?
Yeah.
And that would be my preferred way of going about it. But, you know, they, as usual, didn't ask me. So the reality is that they've gone after the supply. And I just say, well, they've gone after the supply. They're telling you that the prices are going to be higher.
Why is that? They no matter how many times it fails, you watch these political bodies, they always reach for going after the supply. And I just don't get it. Like,
because I think that it's harder to tell people that they're going to have, you know, gas tax. They'll view it as a, you know, but it's easier. So if the big,
we'll double the price of oil, but we're not going to tax it.
Right. And so that's in essence what's going to happen. It just ends up being that it's way easier to do that than to look people in the eye and say, it's just like the people that tell you that they are willing, they want to do stuff for the environment, but they're not willing to, you know, go to, you know, Mexico every second, you know, twice a year.
Right.
And I don't like, so anyways. We're getting ourselves into a lot too much trouble here, Zach, with the politics. So let's not worry. Let's not do too much politics. Okay, let's go on to the next thing, uranium. Completely love it. I think it's, in terms of a long-term play, it's one of those kind of themes that I just own and I don't even think about too much.
Yeah.
Because the reality is that we are going more towards electric, and I'm not trying to dispute by any means that that's not a good thing. And I do think it is a good thing. And I think that eventually uranium is really the only way that we can power the world to compete with, you know, on the level with fossil fuels. And so you have a commodity that's trading below the cost of production and there's no new mines coming on. It's like, to me, it's something you own and you don't think about. The one problem I would say, and I would warn people, some of the junior uranium kind of mines get a lot of speculative attention, but the reality is that they're never going to get produced. So you got to think about them almost as trading sardines.
It's similar in that way. I've noticed that as well, and it reminds me very much of the precious metals industry, right? Like.
I think it's even worse, though.
Really?
Because the reality is that, think about it, we're below the cost of production. Like, some mines, instead of mining, were buying in the open spot market.
Right.
Because it was cheaper for them to, you know, fulfill their long-term contracts by buying in spot.
And okay, this was so, with the... I'm glad you brought that up, because that's one of the questions I wanted to ask you. I have never seen commodity producers... And there was a number of them. I don't know how many there were, but I mean, it was more than five that went into the open market and started buying up free uranium. Do you think that was the motivation behind it, simply because they could buy it up cheaper, or were they trying to burn through that excess supply floating around out there to get to a real price sooner rather than later?
No. They were buying it because instead of mining it, it's cheaper to go buy it on the spot. So why not? And listen, there might be part of them that are riverboat gamblers and they're just like, I'm going to own this as well. So they're levering up their balance sheet. There's no doubt that there's probably, you know, it is, after all, junior uranium companies.
Like, right. Kind of a speculative sector.
Yeah. So, like, I'm sure some of them are just like, you know, they're one step off GameStop in terms of the speculative nature of it. But it's very unusual for a commodity to be trading below that cost. Especially for extended periods of time.
Yeah, and this has been going on for a while.
Yeah. So, you know, in terms of catalysts, because one of the things about that has always been, you know, let's face it, the uranium stories, what, 2 years ago people were telling this story? And it was
three. Yeah, it's been a while.
Nothing's really, not that much has changed.
Right.
But I will say that the one interesting kind of recent development that might be a spark is that, you know how there's the uranium participation unit?
Yeah.
It's a closed-end fund that owns uranium. Because not everyone can own uranium. Like, you and I can't go buy uranium and store it in our, you know, like, it's not like gold.
Is that the uranium fund that Sprott?
Yeah, that's it. So it was previously somewhat independent. I can't remember who started it, but they started this fund, and it was created to own uranium, and then the shares trade based upon this. Now, that's actually what's known as a closed-end fund. A closed-end fund is you can't redeem or create. Okay. Now, the problem with the closed-end fund is that it can go to premiums or discounts to the actual NAV, net asset value. So you're never sure. You know, it's a little bit like that whole Grayscale Bitcoin Trust. At one point, it was a 20% premium to Bitcoin. And now, you know, kind of 6 months later, it was a 20% discount. And so this uranium participation unit suffered from the same fate. Now, the interesting thing about it is that Sprott, who is a money manager here in Canada, and they focus on doing kind of precious metals, and they have physical, you know, ETFs that they own the metal in a jurisdiction where they won't get it taken away, because let's face it, a lot of gold bugs are still remembering, you know, which president opened all the safes and took everyone's gold?
That was FDR.
Yeah. So what was that? 22 or if I got
no,
this right?
No. That I thought it
the
was
gold
in
the, confiscation.
I thought it was in the Great. Yeah, I thought it was in the Great Depression. I thought it was like 32.
Okay. Let's just have a look here. Gold confiscation, Executive Order 6102. 33. You got it. So yeah. March of 33. So many gold bugs remember this, and you know we never did this here in Canada. So one of the things is that they view us as a little safer. And so they'll go, and we actually have the gold, and it's sitting there, and it's all accounted for. And so you'll find that some of the real hard gold bugs, they'll buy this, you know, Sprott physical gold, or, you know, PS, I can't remember the symbol. Anyway, it doesn't matter. You can go look it up, Sprott physical gold, Sprott physical silver. Anyway, Sprott went, and they decided to expand their offering, and they went and bought this uranium participation unit. And one of the things is that they're more inclined to whenever it trades at a premium, to actually issuing shares and buying more uranium. And one of the big kind of problems before was that it would go to a premium and these guys that were running it weren't on top of it. And so if you were an institutional owner, you didn't want it going to a 20% premium because it kind of created an environment where you were getting marked around the discount or premium to NAV. So it wasn't very reliable. So now Sprott's gone. They're taking it over. They're going to make it, you know, try to track NAV much more closely. And then more importantly, they're going to list it on the New York Stock Exchange. So we could see a situation where big institutional owners will now have a vehicle to clean up all the excess supply. So in the past, we've seen, as you mentioned, some companies buying it and just kind of storing it or, you know, or delivering in a combination of those. But now for the first time, we're going to see a situation where big money can reliably go and clean up that excess supply.
Just saw a lot more money flowing into that space.
Yeah. And that's the real problem. And you know, people that aren't familiar with the story, the reality is that when the kind of the wall came down in the USSR and we needed less nuclear arms, we basically had a couple of decades of all this supply as that we've taken apart missiles coming onto the market. And this is why, you know, we've had this kind of constant excess supply. But you know, eventually that's going to get down, and then the problem is we haven't made any new mines in the meantime, and we're almost through it, and we're getting there, and ultimately this is going to occur at the same time that there's going to be a lot more uranium needed for electrification, because you're seeing China, and I think that's where the real market's going to be. China needs way more energy than people are anticipating, and they've looked at this and they realize that solar and wind's great, but they can't move the needle. Like, you need a constant base load. And uranium's what you need.
What about, okay, so, and this is my last one, because I know you got to go and you've been more than generous with your time. What about gold? I'm a bit indifferent with it here at this level. I think long-term it will probably be a big winner,
But what are your thoughts on gold in this environment?
So I love gold. This is probably going to show my age a little bit, Zach. I think gold, you know, everyone's been very upset with the performance of gold, you know, notwithstanding last month where it's finally got out of bed. But up until that point, it had really lagged. And over the last kind of year, and I always said that the reality is that Bitcoin sucked a lot of the kind of wind out of its sails. It accomplished a lot of the things that those people that were worried about, you know, easy monetary policy and stuff would have previously bought gold, and instead they're buying Bitcoin. And I think it was a lot. And I think it caused a lot of it caused gold to sag, and it caused gold to underperform. And whereas everyone else looked at it and was all despondent about gold, I said, listen, you know, we've had 6 months or 9 months of it going sideways. If this is the worst that it's going to do because of all the money that's flowing into Bitcoin, I'm fine with it. And the reason that I like gold is that ultimately I do believe that financial repression will continue. Mm-hmm. And financial repression is the central bank keeping rates below the rate of inflation. And that ultimately, that's, you know, the Federal Reserve has told you that they're willing to take more inflation and that they're willing to kind of not raise rates as quickly. And in that environment, you need to own an asset that's nobody's liability, that's a real asset. And to me, gold is an important part of it. And I've said this, and I will continue to say this, that ultimately there will be reach a point where gold goes up $1,000 in a week. And I know that sounds crazy. Like, everyone's like, oh, that's crazy. But, like, think about what's happening in AMC. Think about what's happening in lumber. It's really not that crazy. Gold's not as big a market as you might guess.
And well, I was joking around a little while ago. I was like, you guys think this is crazy. Wait till these Wall Street Bets folks and the Reddit crowd finds junior gold miners.
Yeah, so you're right. Although I think that the real people that will be pushing gold up and that sort of things will be central banks.
Agreed.
I don't think it's going to be the Wall Street Reddit and those guys that they can move oil, gold around a little bit and stuff like that. But that what's going to cause this eventually is kind of a belief that, you know what, I got to own some more gold for my, you know, my central bank. And they're going to realize that the whole world's inflating and that in a period of inflation that they should diversify into different assets, and it's not good enough to own the, you know, American dollar when they're going to have financial repression. And it's going to become a more attractive asset class for a central banker. And I think you're going to see a situation where you're going to have like a $300 up day and then a 400 and then maybe 100 and then, you know, and it's going to, you're going to turn around and it's going to be a week and it's going to be up $1,000. And I think that it'll be the Russian central bank, the Chinese central bank, it'll be them buying it. And when they come for it, they're going to come for it big. And this is a tiny, tiny little market. And so to me, it's one of those things that if I don't own gold, I feel like I'm naked. I don't have anything. Like, yeah.
Yeah.
And I'll just give you one last thing in terms of all of these things that I'm talking about is based upon the signals that I'm seeing from the kind of government and the central bankers, what they're telling me. And so one of the things that I want to just emphasize, the last little kind of caveat that I'll give everyone, is that if you see it changing, if you see something kind of altering in terms of the government's attitude about debt, or if you see all of a sudden the Republicans showing more oomph and a chance in the midterms. And like, that's really what scares me. Like, we didn't talk about what could go wrong with these scenarios that I'm talking about. To me, it's all based upon Biden going out and spending more and doing all these things. And what happens if the Republicans have a great showing in the midterms? Well, then what's going to happen is that they're not going to be able to spend anything. It's going to be a return of the Obama administration, and we're going to see a return. And what we're going to see is we're going to see less spending, which is going to mean less inflation.
I don't know, Kev, because I, you know, if you look at Trump, the Trump administration, it wasn't
but
exactly
that's because they were controlling it. There's like, I, you know.
Oh, because they were getting credit for the spending, right.
Yes. And it was also in the form of tax cuts.
Right.
And, you know, so we're going to see, I think that you have to be careful. And by the same token, in terms of gold, so that's my worry about inflation. And then in terms of gold, if all of a sudden I saw the Federal Reserve changing their tune And I saw them saying, no, you know what? This inflation, average inflation targeting is actually for the birds. You know, we're going to raise rates. We're going to get out ahead of the curve. And I saw real rates rising. Then I would change my tune. Mm-hmm. But in the meantime, I don't see either one of those things happening. And so I think that the surprises will be to the upside. I think the surprises will be to the upside on the economy. I think the surprises will be upside on markets. And I think that the surprises will be to the upside on inflation.
Well, we just went around the world, pal.
That was fun.
That was fantastic. I thank you so much for coming on and giving us
my
an
pleasure.
Update. And then for those of you that don't follow Kevin, obviously I'd strongly suggest that you do. And they can get you at the Macro Tourist on Twitter, right?
Yeah. Oh no, sorry. That's for the subscribers. Oh. It's at Kevin Muir on Twitter.
Okay.
And you can check out my newsletter at themacrotourist.com. And if anyone wants to, just send me a note, kevin@themacrotourist.com, and I'm happy to fire off them some recent examples.
And another reason why I think people should do that, and I'm really not blowing smoke here, but I think you offer some great advice, and you've helped us. You've been a help to me and have helped us make money for our clients. So couldn't appreciate your work more, man. And more importantly, it's just always great to catch up to you. You're a knowledgeable guy that's also humble, and I just really appreciate the time and can't thank you enough for coming on.
I always have a great time with you guys and the good people of Seattle.
Yeah, well, you have a good time with me because your taste is questionable. but anyway, all right, pal. We'll get to that mountain bike trip that I know that you wanted to do today. And thank you again for your time. We'll be reading your reports as always, and can't wait till we catch up next time.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
You bet. All right, you guys, we got to run. Thank you for tuning in. That's it for today, but as always, we will be back next week, so don't forget to tune in. Have another good interview dialed up for next week. You don't want to miss it. Anyway, we got to run. Have a great weekend. This is the Know Your Risk Radio podcast. Download and subscribe at knowyourriskradio.com.
Opinions expressed in this program are for general information purposes only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual or any specific security. It is only intended to provide education about the financial industry. To determine which investments may be appropriate for you, consult your financial advisor prior to investing. Any past performance discussed during this program is no guarantee of future results. Any indices referenced for comparison are unmanaged and cannot be invested into directly. As always, please remember investing involves risk and possible loss of principal capital. Please seek advice from a licensed professional. Bulwark Capital Management is an investment advisor representative of Clear Creek Financial Management, a registered investment advisor.